We're back with Backstory. I'm Peter Onuf, your guide to the 18th century.
And I'm Ed Ayers, your guide to the 19th century.
And I'm Brian Bellow, guiding you through the long and winding 20th century. Today's topic, the history of Supreme Court nominations. So far, we've focused on the process itself and how that's changed. But we should probably take a moment to address a basic question. And that question is this. The Constitution doesn't say anything about how many justices there should be on the court. So, guys, how did we end up with the number 9?
Well, guess what, Brian? It's the decision of Congress in a series of acts. The Judiciary Act of 1789 and subsequent legislation, which moves us from 6 to 7, and then up to 9 and 10 and back to 9. All that dizzy, those dizzy changes in your century, Ed.
Well, they are. And, you know, it's okay that you went ahead and described it in my century, Peter. Because what's amazing is clear how little sense of the sanctity of that number that there was. And, you know, one of them they have, you know, right after the Civil War. Well, we said it was 10, but, you know, when three guys retire, maybe it'll be 7. Well, nope, we changed our mind. That's okay. Maybe 9. So it kind of crystallized in the 1860s and 70s around 9.
Yeah. So were people upset about that, you know, when the numbers changed?
No, wait, you got to think what this is tied to is the geographic growth of the country. You know, we will remember Peter telling us about how circuit riding and all this. And so the courts are tied to actually covering parts of the country.
Right.
And it's not surprising that as you have more and more country, you need more and more courts.
Right. That's a great reminder, though, of how important those sections in those states were, that this was a union. This was not, you know, a powerful national government.
Well, it also just reminds you how much more interesting the 19th century was than today, because now, you know, the playing field is defined. But that was like a game when they kept drawing the boundaries over and over again.
Yeah, it's just remarkable to me when you think about the uproar that Roosevelt's court packing caused in 1937. Now, what was that court packing? Well, Roosevelt was very frustrated that the Supreme Court had become so comfortable and respected that it was overturning some of the key New Deal legislation, overreaching what we would call judicial activism today. And so he had a pretty simple plan. And listening to you guys, it was basically historically accurate. There's no fixed number in the Constitution, the number of justices. So he reached back to a 19th century maneuver to say, well, you know, for every justice over the age of 70, and there were 6 of them at the time, we can increase the size of the Supreme Court if they don't retire.
Well, it's interesting because it wasn't about sectional growth. It was really about the growth of the workload.
Yeah. Right?
Exactly.
And so these older guys are going to need some help.
Or so he said.
Nice.
So he said, at any rate, the country, even Democrats, drew the line at that. Even moderate Democrats looked around and said, well, wait a second. If we break down this line of division between the executive and the Supreme Court, and we can just have a president appoint as many people as well, is he going to be the next Hitler? Is he going to be the next Mussolini? And that fear of totalitarian government.
Which people were playing on anyway to attack FDR, right?
Absolutely. So in some ways it was trumped up, but in many ways, in my opinion, it was a legitimate concern, tampering with the very Constitution that Americans by this time thought is the thing that distinguishes us.
That's interesting, but he wasn't really trampling with the Constitution.
He was just trampling
with convention.
With tradition.
Yeah.
And apparently I learned from you guys a pretty short-lived tradition.
Yeah, but I think it should be said that the way American lawyers and courts respect the Constitution is a way of saying this is still the same country. We have the same fundamental law. And that same spirit or principle applies in what we might call settled issues. So it's a kind of originalism that is, if something has been this way, time out of mind, which in this case would be 70 years or so.
Right. That's a long time in American history.
That's as if it were in the original Constitution.
Right. So it's interesting. It's almost like in the common law tradition, what is must be wise.
Right.
And if Roosevelt's going to start fooling with that, what's his motivation?
By bringing into the judicial system a steady and continuing stream of new and younger blood, I hope first to make the administration of all federal justice from the bottom to the top speedier and therefore less costly. Secondly, to bring to the decision of social and economic problems younger men who have had personal experience and contact with modern facts and circumstances under which average men have to live and work. This plan will save our national constitution from hardening of the judicial artery.
We have another caller on the line. It's Pam in McHenry, Illinois. Pam, welcome to Backstory.
Thank you very much.
And we're talking about the courts today, and you have a question.
Yes. Locally, our local judges can be elected. And I was wondering why the Supreme Court has to be chosen by the president and voted on, of course, by the Congress. Why was there such a crossing between the executive branch and the judicial branch?
Right.
Doesn't that cause conflict of interest?
Well,
or undue influence?
Yeah. Well, you're talking about separation of powers, one of our cherished mm-hmm. constitutional principles. But
yes.
Brian and Ed are going to talk about the real problems that have emerged. But I'll talk a little bit about the backstory. And that is simply that the judiciary historically grew out of the executive. It's an aspect of the executive. The courts in colonial America were the king's courts, and writs ran in the name of the king. So the idea of the separation of the judiciary from the executive, that's a work in progress, and the U.S. Constitution begins the work, but it's not complete, you might say. So the idea that the judiciary is elective, for instance, where you live, well, that emerged later in American history. That is, the notion that democracy demands that the elective principle apply to all branches to give them that kind of independence.
Oh, come on, Peter. Just say what you really think. Your people didn't want democracy. They wanted a republic.
Well, I don't know. Pam, are you ready for this? The founders were...
Hold on to your populist britches, Pam.
No. The founders had a deep distrust for democracy. In a way, it was a dirty word.
Well, of course they did.
Yeah.
They were a bunch of rich guys.
Well, okay. All right. Now we got it going. Let me put it this way. I'm not going to make a judgment on this, but the demos, or the people, or the plebeians, the lower sort, were understood not to be the whole people. That is, all of us, and we're all created equal, of course. They were thought to be a particular order or class that had its own interests. And because they were ignorant and poor, they would use their power to take property away from everybody else. That was the general idea or feeling. So there was a pejorative connotation to democracy that has been washed away in the years because, of course, we celebrate ourselves as being a great democracy. And that's a wonderful irony because the Supreme Court is right at the center of our self-conception of living under the rule of law in a great democracy. But the Supreme Court is, of course, fundamentally anti-democratic.
Yeah, fortunately, we have the 19th century, Pam. And that was a century that loved democracy, right, Ed?
You know, we really did, Brian. And matter of fact, it was up to us really to kind of put a lot of flesh on the bones of these institutions of democracy. And the person who really took advantage of this was Andrew Jackson, who comes into power feeling that he has a great mandate from the American people. And he comes up with this idea that we may remember from our textbooks about the spoils system. Do the victors go the spoils? And he goes, boy, some of the better spoils are these Supreme Court positions that we can put on there, right? So he puts six men on the Supreme Court, and he makes no bones about who they are. You know, they're people who had supported him.
They're buddies.
Yeah, they are, and he thinks, great, this will help smooth relationships between the branches. And the person who ends up playing the largest role in American history that Andrew Jackson nominates is Roger B. Taney. And it looks like Taney, just in case you're listening out there in the high school kids and want to impress your friends by pointing out that no, it's actually pronounced Taney for some reason I don't understand.
There's a free party trick from Backstory.
Exactly. You know, so that kind of establishes the pattern of the Supreme Court becoming an ally in partisanship. And even the much-beloved Abraham Lincoln sees nothing wrong with making the head of his campaign, David B. Davis, the nominee for the Supreme Court. So across the 19th century, it's well-established precedent to use the Supreme Court as a place to put your best friends. You assume that they are men of intelligence and accomplishment, but they're also men of helpfulness.
And the rationale is, we do this because the president represents the people.
Right.
He's democratically elected, and those people want to be represented in that second branch of government.
Exactly.
As well.
How else would we know who is worthy of the public trust without the process of democracy? So that's the rationale. There's no great deep ambivalence or embarrassment about this.
Right.
It's just the way that things seem
things
to be.
Were. Yeah, and the one thing I'd say, Pam, is during Ed's period, during the 19th century, democracy was reflected through the political parties and partisanship. And by the end of Ed's century, in the beginning of the 20th century, the progressives came along and said, you know, these parties are actually distorting the will of the people. Why shouldn't we let people vote directly for what they really want so we can break this stranglehold of these parties? So they came up with the initiative. They came up with the referendum. And when Teddy Roosevelt ran on the Bull Moose Party in 1912, this was after he had been president. He wanted to be president again. He lost. But one of his party platforms was electing judges so that they could take that middle person out of the formula, take those political parties out and go right to the people.
Well, another reason I like Teddy.
Right.
Yeah, he's definitely your kind of guy. And that's where you got, it's a progressive era where you got a lot of those elected judges. And you got something else. You got the recall where you could actually get rid of judges if people didn't like them. We're very fortunate here on Backstory that we don't have a recall.
We're not elected, are we?
No, we're not.
You know, but, you know, Pam, one of the things is, and I think this is what Ed was talking about, is as the presidency has been more and more conceived of in democratic terms, that the president has a mandate, then the appointment powers of the president do supposedly, in theory, reflect the will of the people.
That's in theory, but not reality.
Yeah.
Well, Pam, isn't it possible that there have been some good appointed judges? You really think that electing judges would work out well? Have you followed some of the California referenda lately?
Have you checked out on Congress? How do we feel about the elective principle there?
My problem with it is that they're more concerned with conservative or liberal instead of those that follow the letter of the law.
Yeah. Well, Pam, you have opened up the proverbial hornet's nest and Pandora's box all in one, and that is, what is the letter of the law? Do we mean a higher law, a law that maybe has some elements of law of nature, natural law? Do we mean it's something that people shouldn't mess with? Or is law what our lawmakers do when they make law? So I think it's that fundamental ambiguity about the nature of law that gives the Supreme Court its room to play in and to assert a major role for itself. But I would like to conclude with a point, and that is, when we are skeptical about the motivations of our politicians in our democracy, then we don't trust anybody. So it's not so much that the Supreme Court is not responsive to us. In a way, too many of the people who serve in government are responsive to us. And sometimes we look into the mirror and we don't like what we see. But the government are us, as they say in the toy world. So anyway, on that really inspirational note, thanks so much for calling.
Okay.
All right, Pam.
Thank you very much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
So guys, could we agree that the court has become increasingly open to democratic influence since Peter's period?
I guess what I would say, Brian, is that it's been open in different ways to democratic influence. And the 19th century is open to the hurly-burly of American politics.
And party politics.
Exactly. You know, today it's open in the sense that everybody's watching. right? But in some ways, it's been narrowed to talk about issues of ideological consistency and of a certain kind of character. Somebody better have never really messed up in their lives before, right?
Yeah.
But it's not really democratic in the sense that if we assume that the party that won in the last election that elected
the president. It's not cabinet government.
Yeah, exactly. So I'd say that it's what we consider democracy or openness has shifted.
Well, yeah. You know what? I mean, to really come back to today's topic, what has become democratic or at least allowed for democratic input is the nominating process. This is where everyone gets their say. But what that has to do with the nature of the court itself once those people are approved is completely unclear to me. It's almost as though we have a kind of therapeutic, democratic bloodletting so that we can pretend this is a democratic institution, and then the court goes on with its business.
Right. Yeah, I think the real challenge here is to understand that democracy means much more than elections. There are many ways in which we participate in this government. And Americans recognize that majorities can endanger their interest. Consider the number of people who are in the minority at any given moment who might find the choice of the majority at that moment to endanger their liberties and rights.
Yeah, we've created a great country where everybody feels in the minority all the time.
Right. Isn't that amazing? One question they don't ask in polls is, what do you think about the wisdom of the people? And do you trust the people? That's something you can't say. This is taboo. But if you honestly answer this question, most people, much of the time, particularly when pet issues come up and fundamental values come up, they're going to say, no, actually, I don't. Yeah.
If you're right, Peter, then don't we, in fact, need a more insulated branch of government? Or, Ed, don't we have to have a Supreme Court that is willing to step in when perhaps the people act in ways mm-hmm. that are not terribly wise?
Yeah, I think, despite the grumbling about the Ivy League bias of all this, you don't really see people who say, let's just choose more stupid people in the Supreme Court. But what people are saying is we want people who remember what real democracy looks like, what it's like to be somebody who didn't have the chance to go to the Ivy League, somebody who is really committed to listening to all the American people. So to answer your opening question, Brian, yes, we're more open and democratic than we used to be. But with every generation, what that means is changing.
Yeah.
And we're no exception.
That's all the time we have for our show today. But as always, the conversation continues online. Drop in at backstoryradio.org and tell us whether the history of Supreme Court nominations makes you feel better or worse about the way things work today.
You can find us on Facebook and at backstoryradio.org. All of our past episodes are there, as is a link to our free podcast, Don't Be a Stranger.
Today's episode of Backstory was produced by Tony Field with help from Catherine Moore and Eric Verkirky. Jamal Milner mastered the show, and Gabi Alter wrote our theme. Special thanks today to the website oyez.org, that's OYEZ, for use of their archival audio. Backstory's executive producer is Andrew Windham.
Major production support for Backstory is provided by the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation and by the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation, committed to the idea that the future may learn from the past.
Support also comes from the David A. Harrison Fund for the President's Initiatives at the University of Virginia, UVA's Miller Center of Public Affairs, the National Endowment for the Humanities, Cary Brown Epstein, and the W.L. Lyons Brown Jr. Charitable Foundation, James Madison's Montpelier, Marcus and Carol Weinstein, Trish and David Crow, J.M. Weinberg, Austin Ligon, and an anonymous donor.
Peter Onuf is the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation Professor of History at the University of Virginia. Brian Ballow is a Professor of History at the University of Virginia and UVA's Miller Center of Public Affairs. Ed Ayers is President and Professor of History at the University of Richmond. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for VFH Radio at the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities.